The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the September 5th, September 12th, 2025 issue of the Week. And for some reason, my music's not working today, but we'll just do without it. The cover drawing this week is Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. He is walking down a city street, and behind him are six National Guardsmen. He's got a stern look on his face, and the headline is Occupy Chicago, Trump and Hegseth's Plan for the Windy City and Other Blue Strongholds. That's going to be our first main story. I'm going to start with the editor's letter. But just a reminder that this is one of the two-week issues. The folks are taking a Labor Day off, I guess. And so we'll do more of the current news this week and then go a little deeper with some of the other features next week. William Falk is the editor-at-large who wrote this. He was the executive editor for a while, and I think he's semi-retired, but he's has some interesting thoughts. As the United States descends into one-man authoritarian rule, I sometimes wonder what Donald Trump's collaborators really think. By collaborators, I do not mean the true MAGA cultists who welcome his tyrannical intrusion into every aspect of American life, his military occupation of American cities, and his unrestrained use of government power to intimidate and punish opponents, critics, and immigrants. The collaborators are the once principled Reaganites, the small government libertarians, and the conservative commentariat who, through fear or tribal allegiance, are still defending or downplaying the maximum leader's insistence that everyone, private companies, universities, museums, states, cities, the Fed, the Justice Department, other countries, must capitulate to his will or suffer his wrath. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is a useful example. In 2016, Rubio compared Trump to a third world strongman and warned that many people on the right will have to explain and justify how they fell into this trap of supporting Donald Trump because this is not going to end well. Does little Marco now feel this is likely to end well because he's sold his soul? Before his own cynical conversion, J.D. Vance observed that Trump was an idiot who was unfit for our nation's highest office and might turn into America's Hitler. Is the sour tang of tyranny more palatable now that J.D. sits at the ruler's table? And what of Senators Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham, the Russia hawks, the Supreme Court justices, and the Republicans who once professed loyalty to free markets, free speech, and personal liberty, and celebrated America's role as the shining city on the hill? Do they privately cringe over the North Korea-style groveling at Trump's cabinet meetings, his fawning admiration of the war criminal Vladimir Putin, his assault on laws, alliances, science, data, and reality itself, and the authoritarian precedents he is setting for future presidents? Do they ever say to spouses or confidants, "My God, he's crazy, he's out of control"? Their silence is their acquiescence and makes them complicit in the damage already done and whatever insanity is to come. And we will do both of the main stories today, starting with the one referenced in the cover drawing. Pentagon readies military deployment in Chicago. What happened? Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker assailed President Trump for his threat to send the National Guard into Chicago this week, calling it an illegal and un-American scheme hatched by a wannabe dictator. Trump cited Chicago, New York, and Baltimore as possible next targets for federal intervention, while claiming his takeover of Washington, D.C.'s police force and deployment of National Guard troops and federal law enforcement agents to the nation's capital had made the hellhole city safe. Washington Post reported that the Pentagon has spent weeks sketching out a plan that would see thousands of the Illinois National Guard deployed in Chicago. The use of active duty troops had also been discussed. Calling the nation's third most populous city a killing field, Trump said he could solve Chicago in a week or less. Pritzker noted Chicago has seen a 32% homicide drop since last year, and many Republican-run cities have higher murder rates. Trump's real goal is not to fight crime, the Democrats said, but to lay the groundwork to circumvent our democracy, militarize our cities, and end elections. Trump signed an executive order directing Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to create a quick reaction force in the Guard available for rapid nationwide deployment to cities where public safety and order has been lost. Under Hegseth's order, some of the more than 2,200 Guard troops in D.C. began carrying weapons on patrol. The troops have largely been stationed in heavily touristed areas like the National Mall, and some have been assigned to trash removal and landscaping duties. Trump said Democrats who oppose his Blue City interventions are walking into a trap, and that his shows of force would be welcomed by a crime-weary public. They say, "He's a dictator. He's a dictator," Trump said at an Oval Office event. A lot of people are saying, "Maybe we'd like a dictator. I don't like a dictator." He dismissed questions about whether he can legally deploy soldiers to Chicago without Governor Pritzker's approval. "I have the right to do anything I want to do," he said. "I'm the President of the United States." What the columnist said. "No thank you," said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. "We've seen what's unfolded in D.C., where residents have endured the dystopian presence of armed soldiers patrolling neighborhoods that fit nobody's definition of crime-riddled. The show of military power in Georgetown and on the Mall exposes the supposed crime emergency as little more than a pretext for Trump to display his vision of a muscular executive branch intervening in the affairs of urban America. That's the last thing Chicago needs. Trump is selling a dangerous lie about the city I've made a life in," said Kimberly Atkins Storr in the Boston Globe. "D.C. is a vibrant metropolis where, despite Trump's claims, nobody was afraid to go out to dinner. But restaurants are suffering now because residents are staying home, spooked by an armed occupation that bears all the hallmarks of a fascist regime. In immigrant neighborhoods, there are deserted streets and a palpable sense of fear," said Daniela Silva and Megan Lebowitz in NBCNews.com. "Residents report groups of ICE agents grabbing men off the streets and checkpoints where every driver is asked for identification." Margarita, a Salvadoran immigrant who runs a restaurant, said half her employees are afraid to come to work. "People are traumatized," she said. "This is tricky territory for Democrats," said Rachel Bade in Politico. 8 in 10 Washingtonians oppose Trump's D.C. occupation, but Trump is playing to a national audience. Crime stats in D.C., Chicago, and other cities may be down, but citing numbers only goes so far when people feel unsafe, and Democrats who dismiss their concerns are playing a losing game. They need to look at last week's Harvard poll, which showed that 54% of voters think Trump's actions in Washington are justified and necessary. "My hometown of Chicago and other big cities really are irreparably broken," said Jeffrey Blahar in National Review. "But in Chicago, so vast it makes D.C. look like a torn postage stamp, flooding the loop with troops won't fix anything, no matter how brilliant it might be politically. And there's another catch. It's blatantly illegal. Trump's lust for power can't override a constitution that grants police powers to the states, not the federal government." Trump's goal of a civil rapid reaction force is sparking alarm among some former National Guard brass, said Ann Flaherty in ABC News. The Guard's mission is to help fight foreign enemies or aid Americans in times of extraordinary crisis. But Trump wants units whose purpose is to dominate and police the American people, said retired Major General Randy Manner. And that is extremely disturbing. Using troops for domestic law enforcement could have unsettling consequences, said retired Major General Linda Singh. What happens if there's an escalation and civilians are killed? She said. We are setting precedents we can't come back from. America has turned a dangerous corner, said Garrett Graff in his newsletter. We've suddenly become a country where armed officers of the state shout, "Papers, please," at people heading home from work. A country where masked men throw people into unmarked cars, disappearing them into an opaque system where their family members beg for information. Now Trump is threatening domestic opponents such as Pritzker with D.C.-like occupations, claiming emergency powers in a moment where the only emergency is his own abuse of power. This is what American fascism looks like. And our second main story, Trump threatens critics with federal charges. What happened? President Trump ramped up his retribution campaign this week, threatening to prosecute former ally-turned-critic Chris Christie, just days after FBI agents searched the home and office of former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Federal agents raided Bolton's Washington, D.C. office and his suburban home last week, seizing computers and documents as part of an investigation into alleged illegal sharing of classified information. Ahead of the raid, Bolton had angered Trump with public criticism of his policy toward Russia, and the president had spent days attacking him on social media. While Trump later denied foreknowledge of the FBI raid, he said Bolton deserved it because he was a real sort of lowlife and unpatriotic. Undeterred, Bolton wrote an op-ed in the Washington Examiner listing numerous mistakes he said Trump had made regarding Russia that have left us further from peace in Ukraine, saying falsely that he could prosecute anyone he wanted to because he was America's chief law enforcement officer. Trump turned his ire on other critics. After Christie denounced the raid on Bolton, Trump threatened to reopen a criminal investigation into Bridgegate, an alleged act of political retaliation that took place when Christie was New Jersey governor. The president also said he would have to rethink federal funding for rebuilding Baltimore's damaged Key Bridge after Maryland Governor Wes Moore warned him against sending troops to that city. And he announced he would fire Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook, claiming she had committed mortgage fraud. This is clearly retribution, said Senator Adam Schiff, himself a target of Justice Department mortgage fraud probe. Anyone who says anything adverse to the president's interests gets the full weight of the federal government brought down on them. What the editorial said. It's hard to see the raid against Bolton as anything other than vindictive, said the Wall Street Journal. Bolton fell from favor in Trump's first term and promptly wrote a tell-all memoir describing Trump as ignorant and unfit, which the administration tried unsuccessfully to block from publication. After regaining the presidency, Trump made clear that he was out for blood, pulling Bolton's Secret Service detail, even though Iran had plotted to murder him in retaliation for an assassination Bolton helped orchestrate at Trump's behest. It's the kind of gratuitous viciousness we've come to expect from this president. Even if the FBI finds classified documents in Bolton's possession, the administration has damaged any presumption of good faith by flinging weightless accusations of criminality at those who challenge it, said the New York Times. That includes not just Bolton, Cook, and Schiff, but also New York Attorney General Letitia James, who is being investigated for mortgage fraud, the apparent weapon of choice for Trump's Justice Department. Trump even threatened financier George Soros and his son Alex, prominent donors to Democratic causes, with racketeering charges. What the columnist said. The timing of events was revealing, said Benjamin Witz in The Bulwark. I was there at the start of the raid on Bolton's Maryland home, and no New York Post reporter was present. Yet within minutes, FBI Director Kash Patel had posted about it on X, and the Post's website had a full-length article describing the raid. Clearly, the administration had fed information to the tabloid. Part of the point was to create a theatrical display of law enforcement power against a prominent anti-Trumper. The message, if you criticize Trump, the government is coming for you. All this is ugly indeed, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. But it was Democrats who first abused the law in this way. James first boasted she planned to use her office to harass Trump on the night she was elected in 2018, well before she unearthed evidence of his wrongdoing. The resulting civil fraud trial was a shameful spectacle of judicial and prosecutorial overreach, as evidenced by the fact that the $454 million penalty James levied on Trump was overturned last week. Yet the lengths Trump is going to in punishing his enemies is entirely new and frightening, said Norm Eisen in MSNBC.com. The same institutions marshaled against Bolton can be wielded against anyone. Who's next? It could be judges who issue rulings unfavorable to the administration, lawmakers who block Trump's agenda, or even ordinary citizens who may have written a letter or a post on social media that he objects to. It could be you. Next up is our controversy of the week. Newsom, will his Trump trolling pay off? Gavin Newsom has devised a new strategy to energize Democrats and infuriate Republicans, said Matt K. Lewis in the Los Angeles Times. Act like President Trump. In recent weeks, his social media accounts have shared posts that parody the kind of material that normally fills up Trump supporters' feeds. There's AI-generated of images of Newsom with a cup labeled MAGA Tears, Newsom on Mount Rushmore, and my personal favorite, Newsom getting prayed over by Kid Rock, Tucker Carlson, and an angelic Hulk Hogan. The Democrat has adopted Trump's all-caps writing style as well, posting that his redistricting plan to counter the Texas GOP's gerrymander has led many people to call him Gavin Christopher Columbus Newsom because of the maps. He taunts the president on X with Trumpish insults. Donald is finished. He is no longer hot. And is selling merch, too, including a red baseball cap emblazoned with Newsom was right about everything. For years, Trump was the master of this childish, if devious, game. Now Newsom, who's eyeing the 2028 Democratic presidential nomination, is hitting back and fighting on Trump's turf. After 8 years of Democrats issuing shrill ultimatums about the death of the Republic, it's nice to have someone telling Trump to shove it in the only language he could ever understand, said Luke Winkie in Slate. Newsom isn't the most likable guy, but he's giving his party a taste of what has made Trumpism so appetizing for many Americans. The mean-spiritedness, the compulsive name-calling, the prioritization of emotional truth over objective truth. Against my better judgment, I'm enjoying Newsom's embrace of idiocracy, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. He's holding a mirror up to MAGA, and MAGA doesn't like what it sees. Fox News anchor Trace Gallagher blasted Newsom's post as childish, while his colleague Dana Perino said Newsom will need to be more serious if he wants to be president. So there you have it. All it takes to expose stupid, unacceptable rhetoric as stupid and unacceptable is to change the identity of the speaker. Newsom is putting his presidential ambitions above his state's well-being, said Jim Garrity in National Review. California has the highest unemployment rate in the U.S., an affordability crisis, and growing levels of homelessness. The state needs all the help it can get. Yet Newsom has decided his best strategy is to antagonize the president as much as possible. His zingers may play well online, said Selena Zito in Washington Examiner, but they won't resonate with real swing state voters. Newsom and his advisors, holed up in their Democratic stronghold, have never had to win over Republicans, independents, or centrist Democrats. Those folks don't want a Democratic Trump. They want their candidates showing up, getting shit done, and governing. But voters are rewarding Newsom for putting himself at the center of the fight, said Douglas E. Schoen in The Hill. While former Vice President Kamala Harris still leads in an aggregated poll of Democratic 2028 contenders, Newsom has doubled his vote share nationwide since June. That may be because, amid all the Trump trolling, he's moderated on a long list of polarizing issues, said Ronald Brownstein in Bloomberg. Newsom has expressed opposition to transgender girls playing in school sports and struck hardline notes on crime. He's showing it's possible to be a Democrat who's anti-MAGA without being ultra-progressive. Other Democrats would be smart to adopt Newsom's confrontational centrism. There's a good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for love stories after pop superstar Taylor Swift said yes to her boyfriend of 2 years, Kansas City Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce. Your English teacher and your gym teacher are getting married, the couple posted on Instagram, with photos of Kelce getting down on one knee. It was a good week for faking it after a French Justin Bieber impersonator tricked a Las Vegas nightclub into letting him perform on stage while racking up a $10,000 tab. The Wynn Hotel, where the XS nightclub is located, banned Dylan Desclos from its properties for life and blamed an elaborate and multi-step ruse by him and his advance team. It's a good week for screen breaks after the Japanese city of Takoyaki proposed a health ordinance that would limit residents' smartphone use to 2 hours a day outside work and school. In 2 hours, I cannot even read a book or watch a movie on my smartphone, one social media user griped. But it was a bad week for peace through strength after Vice President J.D. Vance defended President Trump's attempt to mediate an end to the Russia-Ukraine war by stating that every major conflict in human history, including World War II, ended with some kind of negotiation. In fact, World War II ended with the unconditional surrender of Germany and Japan in 1945. It's a bad week for snacking after an advisor to scandal-plagued New York City Mayor Eric Adams tried to hand a local journalist a cashed stuffed potato chip bag outside a campaign event. I just wanted to be her friend, said Winnie Greco, who was suspended from Adams' reelection campaign. And finally, it was a bad week for drunken sailors after a container ship captain was arrested in Seattle on suspicion of operating his 333-meter-long vessel while inebriated. A breathalyzer test found the captain had a blood alcohol level more than 6 times the legal limit for commercial mariners, said the Coast Guard. And in other news, Pentagon purge accelerates with firing of intelligence head. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth last week fired the head of Pentagon's main intelligence branch, Lieutenant General Jeffrey Cruz, just weeks after the agency drafted a report that contradicted President Trump's claim that Iran's nuclear program was fully obliterated in U.S. military strikes in June. A leaked preliminary assessment of that operation from the Defense Intelligence Agency estimated the bombing campaign had set back Iran's nuclear capabilities only by a few months. The White House called the assessment flat out wrong. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, said Cruz's firing was evidence that the administration treats intelligence as a loyalty test. Hegseth has ousted numerous other Pentagon officials in recent months, and last week also fired Vice Admiral Nancy LaCour, Chief of the Navy Reserve, and Rear Admiral Milton Sands, a Navy SEAL officer overseeing Naval Special Warfare Command. We will read some of the short pieces from the U.S. at a glance and the world at a glance this week, starting with the U.S. at a glance. Minneapolis, Catholic school shooting. A shooter killed at least two children at a Minneapolis Catholic school this week, firing through a stained glass window at students who were celebrating the school year's first Mass. The assailant, 23-year-old Robin Westman, the transgender child of a former Annunciation Catholic School employee, then committed suicide. The victims were 8 and 10 years old. The shooting also left at least 17 injured, including 14 children. The church said that the toll would have been worse, but for the heroism of staff who moved children under the pews within seconds. Westman, who identified as female, registered a name change from Robert to Robin in 2020. Police were investigating a series of disturbing videos posted hours before the shooting. One showed gun magazines on which Westman appears to have scrawled, "Kill Donald Trump," "$6 million wasn't enough," and "Where is your God?" The FBI said it would investigate the attack as an anti-Catholic bias crime. Austin, getting redder. Texas Republicans voted last week to implement a new gerrymandered congressional map that could give the party 5 more House seats. After nearly 8 hours of contentious debate, the GOP-controlled Senate passed the new districts in an 18-11 vote along party lines, sending the plan to Governor Greg Abbott's desk. The vote cements a power grab encouraged by the Trump administration and caps off weeks of partisan clashes that culminated in Texas House Democrats fleeing the state to block the bill. The redistricting push has since ballooned into a nationwide arms race, with Vice President J.D. Vance this week urging 55 Indiana GOP lawmakers to redraw their districts by Thanksgiving. Florida is also considering implementing new maps that could target 3 to 5 House seats currently held by Democrats. Meanwhile, blue states have hit back, with Californians set to vote in a November special election on new maps that are likely to increase the number of Democrat-held seats. Washington, D.C. Stars and Stripes. President Trump this week signed an executive order that aims to punish the burning of the American flag, despite 2 Supreme Court decisions holding that flag burning counts as constitutionally protected speech. While the order doesn't criminalize the actual act of flag burning, offenders could be prosecuted for inciting a riot, committing a hate crime, or illegal discrimination against American citizens. If you burn a flag, you get 1 year in jail, Trump told reporters. You will see flag burning stop immediately. Hours later, Secret Service arrested Jay Carey, an Army veteran in Washington's Lafayette Square, after he burned an American flag to protest the executive order. The Supreme Court first upheld the right to burn the flag in 1989 in the case of an activist who had set fire to a flag outside the Republican National Convention in Dallas 5 years earlier. Baltimore. Deportation limbo. A federal judge this week barred the Trump administration from deporting Kilmar Abrego Garcia after a whirlwind 72 hours that saw the Salvadoran immigrant freed from detention only to be detained again and threatened with deportation to Uganda. Maryland District Judge Paula Zenas said she needed time to hold a hearing and ensure Abrego Garcia's due process rights were protected. The Maryland resident was deported to El Salvador in March in violation of a judge's order and returned to the U.S. in June. but then faced human smuggling charges, to which he has pleaded not guilty. He spent the summer detained in Tennessee, but was released last week after a judge ruled he wasn't a flight risk. Days later, immigration officers detained him during a Baltimore check-in. His lawyer said prosecutors gave him the choice of pleading guilty and being deported to Costa Rica, or maintaining his innocence but getting shipped to Uganda. Trump officials insist Abrego Garcia will never go free in the U.S. And the world at a glance. Toronto. No experiments on dogs. Ontario Premier Doug Ford said this week he will introduce a bill to ban medical testing on cats and dogs. Go with the mice, go with the rats, no problem. But these are pets, Ford said. They're part of our families. The push came 2 weeks after an expose by Canada's Investigative Journalism Bureau showed that an Ontario hospital was introducing three-hour heart attacks in beagles as part of a secret cardiac research. The report caused an outcry, and St. Joseph's Hospital in London, Ontario, said that while the research complied with ethics protocols, it would end. If there's anyone else out there that's doing this to animals, Ford said, come clean, because we're going to catch you. Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. Truckers learn English. Commercial truck drivers in Mexico have been flocking to language classes since the U.S. announced in April that they must be able to communicate with U.S. authorities in English or be denied entry at the border. More than 16,000 trucks a day cross the Mexican border into the U.S., and many of their drivers have managed the language gap until now by relying on gestures, translation apps, and the Spanish skills of U.S. officials. The new policy has birthed a new border industry. Intensive courses that teach trucking vocabulary and role play what to do at traffic stops. I applaud the measure, Juan Manuel Talamas, operator of a trucking company in Ciudad Juarez, told the New York Times. But what hasn't been done for many years can't be done overnight. Johannesburg. Women lured to Russia. South Africa opened an investigation last week into reports that Russian firms have been trafficking African women to work assembling drones in the Russian region of Tatarstan. Allegations have appeared in Russian exile and Ukrainian media for months that women from Kenya, Botswana, and elsewhere have been tricked into moving to Russia, and now South African authorities say it may be happening to South Africans too. The traffickers use social media influencers to persuade African women that glamorous jobs await them in Russia. But when the women arrive, they are put to work in drone factories and can't earn enough to leave. South African recruiters working for Russia denied that there was any misrepresentation of work opportunities, but the Ministry for Women warned South Africans to be skeptical of so-called work opportunities abroad. Canberra, Australia. Iran behind arson. Australia kicked out Iranian diplomats this week, saying Iran was responsible for last year's arson attacks on the Jewish community. A kosher restaurant in Sydney was firebombed in October, and a Melbourne synagogue set ablaze in December, injuring one. These were extraordinary and dangerous acts of aggression orchestrated by a foreign nation on Australian soil, said Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. Authorities said Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps ultimately directed the attacks, but hid their involvement in a complicated hierarchy of operatives. Australia is home to the largest number of Holocaust survivors outside of Israel. In the fires and other anti-Semitic attacks that have proliferated since the start of the Gaza War have shaken the community. Iran denied involvement and said it would expel Australian diplomats in return. Jerusalem. Renewed assault on Gaza. The Israel Defense Forces pushed deeper into Gaza City this week, leveling neighborhoods and leaving civilians homeless. Two successive strikes on the only hospital in southern Gaza killed at least 20 people, including five journalists. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the double strike a tragic mishap and said the IDF would investigate. The attacks came after the world's leading body on food security said that Gaza was experiencing severe famine and that Israel was directly responsible, which Israel strongly disputed. In the West Bank, meanwhile, the IDF bulldozed thousands of olive trees in a Palestinian orchard in retaliation for an alleged shooting attack on Jewish settlers that wounded one person. Every village and enemy must know that attacking residents will bring a heavy price, said Major General Avi Bluth. The U.S. has been trying for months to broker a truce between Israel and Hamas, but talks have stalled and a partial ceasefire and hostage release appears to have been ruled out. Still, President Trump held a meeting with U.S. and Israeli officials this week to discuss various scenarios for post-war Gaza, including possible U.S. assistance in development. We think we're going to settle this one way or the other, certainly before the end of this year, said U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff. We will do three of the best columns this week and maybe pick up a few more next week. This week we'll do the three that come from the U.S. The culture war comes for Cracker Barrel. Right-wing culture warriors have been losing their minds over Cracker Barrel, said Jonah Goldberg. The highway pit stop where customers can chow down on chicken fried steak, dumplings, and flowery white gravy recently updated its decor and removed the old white guy in overalls sitting by a barrel from its logo in favor of a text-only sign bearing the company's name. Cue the outrage. The brand has gone woke, cried the critics. Federalist co-founder Sean Davis accused Cracker Barrel's CEO of seeking to brainwash customers with the principles of gay race communism. After President Trump called on the company to bring back the old logo, the company quickly announced it would comply. Cracker Barrel was founded as a gas station eatery in 1969 and is not some grand institution with deep cultural roots in the South, despite its kitschy Southern food, decor, and gimmicky gift shop. Cracker Barrels are little capitalist temples to faux authenticity, and the logo change was an effort to expand its appeal and profits across the country as its older customer base dies off. Heaven forbid anyone blame capitalism for the branding tweak, not when the boogeyman of wokeness is available. Making McCarthyism great again. McCarthyism is back, said Michael Shearer, and its leader is a 32-year-old extremist troll, an anti-Muslim activist and self-described unofficial advisor to President Trump. Laura Loomer has become one of the country's most influential public figures. Trump prizes loyalty above all, so he listens to her despite the warnings, sneers, and eye rolls from other advisors. He has fired dozens of federal employees Loomer has targeted for sins such as past statements in support of diversity or criticism of Trump. She claimed credit last week when Trump's intelligence chief stripped security clearances from 37 national security officers. And she previously persuaded Trump to get rid of six members of his National Security Council, three leaders at the National Security Agency, and Homeland Security official, an assistant U.S. attorney in California, and a federal prosecutor in Manhattan. Loomer embraces the idea that she's the Joseph McCarthy of the Trump era, leading a red scare in which public officials are purged for wokeness rather than communism. We need to make McCarthy great again, she says. Loomer has 1.7 million followers on X, but her real audience consists of one, and the person who matters the most is almost certainly entertained. Shutting off access to COVID shots. Can you still get a COVID shot this fall? It's complicated, said Lisa Jarvis. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said the agency's controls have created widespread confusion through muddled, contradictory messaging, not only about who's eligible, but also by casting doubt on whether the vaccines are safe or even necessary. Kennedy and the Food and Drug Administration have restricted COVID shot recommendations, and thus the likelihood of insurance coverage for the $140 to $200 cost to seniors 65 and over, and people who have health conditions such as diabetes, asthma, and obesity. Kennedy even tried to remove COVID shots from recommended early childhood vaccinations. The CDC later said parents should jointly decide with their pediatricians whether kids get the shots. Most doctors and medical organizations say children under two and pregnant women should be vaccinated because both groups are vulnerable to serious COVID illness. So are millions of other Americans. Those who want to reduce their risk should have access to that option. But thanks to RFK Jr.'s militant quackery, a COVID shot might be harder to find, and you may have to pay for it out of pocket. Go ahead and read two of the obituaries today. The radio host who preached family values, James Dobson, 1936 to 2025. James Dobson's determination to roll back the social changes of the 1960s made him a key figure in the U.S. politics for decades, wielding an influence that is still felt to this day. Horrified by the sexual permissiveness he saw emerging in society, Dobson founded the evangelical group Focus on the Family in 1977, even though he wasn't an ordained minister, but a child psychologist. Over the years, he built the group into a $140 million empire with telecast films, magazines, and radio programs that eventually reached some 220 million listeners in 157 countries. His broadcast centered on family and marital advice, but he frequently worked in his fervent opposition to homosexuality, divorce, abortion, and pornography. And while his group was officially apolitical, it was considered part of the religious right, and its stances made their way into Republican platforms. "We're a moral free fall. We're in a moral free fall," Dobson said in 2002. "Wherever you stick the thermometer into the American culture, you'll find corruption." Born in Shreveport, Louisiana, Dobson came from a family that produced three generations of Church of the Nazarene ministers and frowned upon dancing. Raised in Oklahoma and Texas, he went to California for college, earning a Ph.D. in child development at the University of Southern California in 1967. Just 3 years later, he wrote a bestseller, Dare to Discipline, which encouraged parents to use corporal punishment. "The role of stern prophet was one that came naturally to him," said the Washington Post, "and his broadcast for Focus on the Family combined Old Testament fury with an engaging speaking style. He often railed against homosexuality, calling it a lie of Satan, because Dobson believed the Bible should shape public policy," said NPR. He also created an advocacy arm for the group, the Family Research Council. While he didn't officially endorse a candidate until George W. Bush in 2004, he served on numerous congressional and White House panels. Dobson resigned from Focus on the Family in 2009 to launch a more overtly political podcast, Family Talk, said the New York Times. When Donald Trump became president, Dobson was an enthusiastic fan, supporting his immigration crackdown, praising him as the most pro-life president we've ever had, and excusing his extramarital affairs. He stayed active in politics as long as he could. "Building a power base means nothing to me," he insisted in 1990, "but I do feel I cannot sit on my hands while everything I care about goes down the drain." The promoter who made NASCAR a show, Humpy Wheeler, 1938 to 2025. Known as the P.T. Barnum of motorsports, Humpy Wheeler was a born showman. As longtime manager of the Charlotte Motor Speedway, he turned NASCAR race days into carnivals. He might start the show with a three-ring circus or professional boxing bout, or have stunt drivers do tricks in the infield before races. At one point, he installed a 40-foot-tall, metal-smashing robot called the Robosaurus, which would delight kids by breathing flames and crushing beater cars. His mastery of flair and spectacle made NASCAR's popularity skyrocket, and the Charlotte Speedway became a mecca for not just fans, but also corporate sponsors. Yet despite all the sideshows, Wheeler made sure to prioritize what he called the three T's of event planning: tickets, traffic, and toilets. "We can blow stuff up and set off $175,000 worth of fireworks," he said in 2008, "but we still have to have the product on the track." Howard Augustine Wheeler Jr. was born in a mill town just outside Charlotte, the son of a football coach and a homemaker. By age 13, he was already showing a talent for hyping events, running and breathlessly promoting bicycle races in his neighborhood, said the New York Times. At first, he wanted to be a boxer, and he wasn't bad, winning the Carolina Golden Gloves competition. Persuaded it was too rough a life, he got a football scholarship to the University of South Carolina and majored in journalism. After graduation, he turned to stock car racing, then popular in rural North Carolina. He leased a quarter-mile dirt track where he ran races featuring cheap jalopies that often skidded into one another. "People loved it. It was a crash a minute," he said. Before long, he was running Charlotte Motor Speedway. "Wheeler made the track the premier location for NASCAR," said the Charlotte Observer, "installing the first big lighting system and holding the first night races. He also broke down barriers in the racing world, working diligently to bring on Janet Guthrie as the first woman in a super speedway race. He went on to mentor 100 more racers," said the Washington Post, "including Dale Earnhardt. But he credited his success to the fans. If the community doesn't embrace you," Wheeler said, "you're not going anywhere." This is the business news at a glance. Retail, biggest sellers gain as tariffs sink in. Major retailers reported strong quarters despite tariffs, said Sarah Nasur and Nakasha Khan in the Wall Street Journal. Walmart, widely considered a bellwether for the U.S. consumer, reported last week that its U.S. comparable store sales rose 4.6% in the latest quarter, while TJ Maxx upgraded its sales forecast. Home Depot and Lowe's said there are signs that consumers are holding off on larger projects because of higher interest rates and economic uncertainty, but it's not stopping them from making smaller purchases. And while Walmart has raised prices on about 10% of the products it imports, it has been absorbing the rest to keep shoppers coming through the doors, a strategy that helped it gain market share across all income groups. The world's biggest retail Taylor should be doing well, said Andrea Felstead in Bloomberg. It has the scale and supplier network to deliver the most competitive prices and the profitability to keep those prices low. But a read between the lines of the latest earnings report suggests trouble ahead even for mighty Walmart. It's a significant caution signal that Walmart left its four-year estimate for adjusted operating income unchanged. CEO Doug McMillon also said the company has been hypervigilant in tracking prices, noting that costs were increasing each week. Sales growth shows it is still possible to tempt shoppers to open their wallets, but it's not easy. AI wars. Musk sues Apple and OpenAI. Elon Musk's AI company took on Apple and OpenAI this week over monopolistic behavior, said Annie Palmer in CNBC.com. In a lawsuit, XAI accuses the two firms of colluding to lock up markets in smartphones and generative AI. The suit charges that Apple has been deprioritizing other AI apps in its App Store rankings, which lists XAI's Grok chatbots as number 5 among the top free apps, and ChatGPT as number 1. The lawsuit is the latest twist in an ongoing clash between Musk and OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, who in turn has accused Musk of efforts to harm his competitors and people he doesn't like. Indicators. McDonald's turns to value pricing. McDonald's is lowering the cost of its combo meals, said Heather Haddon in the Wall Street Journal. The burger giant said last week it had come to terms with franchisees to keep the cost of eight popular combo meals 15% below the sum of the individual items' prices. The company will offer subsidies to franchisees who lose money on the discounts. The move comes as part of the chain's push to restore its reputation for affordability after images went viral of Big Mac value meals topping $18. The average large Big Mac meal costs $10.53 today, but the change could bring it down to $8.50. And a few of the real short business pieces. Clean energy projects worth $18.6 billion have been canceled since President Trump took office for his second term. Announced investments in the renewable sector have already fallen by 20%. Meta agreed to spend more than $10 billion on Google Cloud services over the next 6 years, turning to the rival to feed its AI build-out. A one-of-a-kind sports card autographed by NBA legends Michael Jordan and the late Kobe Bryant sold for $12.93 million this week, becoming the most expensive card ever sold. The winning bid surpassed the $12.6 million paid for a mint-condition 1952 Mickey Mantle rookie card in 2022. We have time for at least one of the Talking Points articles. School phone bans, why they're spreading. It's a no-brainer, said John A. Torres in Florida Today. Banning phones in schools is the right thing to do for our kids. Florida is one of 17 states, plus Washington, D.C., enacting all-day phone bans as students head back to school. With 68% of parents supporting some phone limits, 35 states now restrict phone usage in public schools. Some states are imposing bell-to-bell prohibitions on using phones for the entire day, while others bar them during class time, with students granted access between classes and during lunch. Research shows smartphone usage increases children's risk of mental health problems, from depression to cyberbullying, to an inability to focus and learn, said Mary Ellen Klass in Bloomberg. This is one of the few things most American politicians seem to agree upon, with states as blue as California and as red as Kentucky passing bans. Over 90% of children have a phone by 14, and about half have one by 10. If you want kids to thrive, lock up their phones. Actually, most parents want smarter rules, not total bans, said Kerry Rodriguez in USA Today. All-day bans ignore the bigger picture. In a country where mass shootings are too common, children need to be able to contact their parents in emergencies, and parents need to be able to call kids. At shootings in Uvalde, Texas and Parkland, Florida, cell phones saved lives, helping students guide first responders to the shooters. Treating phones as pure distractions suggests they don't have a legitimate and even essential role in students' lives. Technology is an inescapable part of modern life, and schools should be teaching students to build healthy relationships with it. Before the pearl clutching starts about emergencies, let's be clear, said Cameron Smith in the Tennessean. Most bans allow cell phone use in emergencies. The bans address an ongoing daily crisis. An entire generation's brains are quite literally being rewired by constant connectivity, resulting in the erosion of focus, critical thinking, and the ability to engage deeply with material. But enforcing phone restrictions will be about as easy as herding cats on roller skates. So parental support is absolutely crucial. Smartphones are addictive and have put adults and kids alike onto attention treadmills. At home, mom and dad should impose limits and model healthy cell phone behavior. We can't applaud school board policies and then undermine their efforts the moment the bell rings for dismissal. And a couple of the short notes. The White House has released a list of more than 20 Smithsonian exhibits it considers objectionable and woke. They include an LGBTQ pride flag, an artwork depicting migrants watching July 4th fireworks through an opening in the U.S.-Mexico border wall, and an animated portrait of infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony S. Fauci. President Trump was photographed with a dark bruise on his right hand this week, just days after he appeared with a thick layer of makeup covering the apparent injury. He has been spotted multiple times this year with bruises on his hands, which the White House attributed to Trump's prodigious shaking of hands. The president was diagnosed last month with chronic venous insufficiency, a circulatory disorder that can cause swelling in the legs and bruising in the extremities. On the poll watch, 63% of Americans view political corruption as a very serious problem, but just 50% of Republicans agree, down from 66% last year. 48% of Republicans view inflation as a serious problem, down from 89% in 2024. 58% of Americans favor allowing voters to cast their ballots by mail. And we'll finish the show today with a quote from James Baldwin, quoted in the Boston Globe. "The reason I will never hate anybody again is that it's too demeaning a confession on your part if you need to hate somebody. It means you are afraid of the other thing, which is to love and be loved." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.